the MadTech podcast special, focusing on the most important topics in AdTech and MarTech.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the MadTech podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, research lead at ExchangeWire, and today we're going to be talking about all things mergers and acquisitions following a rebounding of activity within the space. To join us, I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Silver, Global President of Corporate Development at MIQ. Hello to you, Paul.
Hello, Matt. Thank you for welcoming me onto the show. I'm a big fan. Pleased to say that this is my first ever podcast, believe it or not.
Oh, interesting. Well, it's a fine topic to be making your debut on. And yeah, we're absolutely delighted to have you here with us. So we'll dive straight into it. And that's after a prolonged quiet spell, investment and M&A dormancy in ad tech is perhaps finally at an end. After a steady ramp up of activity throughout the year, consolidation blossomed in June onwards with scores of acquisitions in the SSP, mobile, CTV and data privacy markets, as well as a range of service providers. So Paul, my first question to you is, what are the conditions that have led to this resurgence in ad tech and MarTech M&A?
Yeah, good question. There's probably not one answer to all of the activity, because you know, a lot of the activity you're seeing is coming from different parts of the industry itself, and likely all driven by different types of reasons. But I think there's a few that come to mind. So one is that, you know, with interest rates coming down or about to come down, you know, debt access is becoming a little bit easier. And obviously that's a huge component of funding for deals for a lot of companies. So I think you're going to start to see a bit more confidence in the ability to raise debt funds and to, you know, apply more leverage to your business in this new sort of environment. I think you're seeing a period now where there's been perhaps some sustained post-COVID growth. So what I mean by that is a lot of companies immediately after COVID, certainly those in the digital space, mobile space, really sort of rode the wave of this sort of digital transformation that accelerates a lot of companies. And a lot of business actually rebounded really quickly after COVID, like exceptionally well. And then sort of over perhaps the preceding or the 18 months after that, perhaps sort of to start to see that growth taper a bit, as you saw. And these all have like big macro effects that can sometimes, you know, put the brakes on some of that growth. But I think we've had a period now where for those companies that have been able to stabilize growth are starting to show themselves being quite resilient businesses in the face of a lot of macro pressure since COVID. So that compounded with, you know, the ability to raise funds a bit easier has probably also contributed to that sort of uptick in activity. And lastly, I think you're starting to see, you know, the sort of the timings where a lot of companies, whether, you know, investment from VC or private equity that came in just around COVID time, 2021 time, you know, approaching now sort of maybe the end of some of their small hold periods, where again, it's like opportunity to start to liquidate some of those and move on to new partners and new investors. So I think all those things together is sort of driving some of this opportunity for M&A. But yeah, probably no real silver bullet there though.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's kind of, if you look at the share prices of many ad tech companies throughout the COVID and post-COVID period, it reads a lot like a roller coaster, but some have been able to ride that wave better than others. And yeah, it's led to those, you know, not just one factor leading to the resurgence in M&A, but yeah, it's all just combined to a single point to really see that influx of activity, which is obviously really great to see and speaks towards a healthy market. Speaking of which, in terms of healthy markets and regulation of those markets, the Google antitrust trial in ad tech kicked off in earnest on Monday the 9th, while an earlier trial ruled that Google commands a monopoly within the search market. Wider antitrust scrutiny is taking place globally, including with a recently filed complaint from the UK Competition and Markets Authority against Google. How has this increased antitrust scrutiny on the big tech platforms increased opportunity for independent-led acquisitions, if at all?
I think it's a bit of a jump to sort of suggest that any M&A currently is being driven by the potential impact of any sort of antitrust outcomes. I'd be very surprised and shocked if any deal makers are sort of making bets with that in mind, because A, the timings of these things is not going to be immediate. The effect of them is unknown. You may have seen some very early stage businesses being backed more prominently by venture capital which it tends to be more of a high risk bet. But I'd be very surprised if any sort of mature businesses are being shopped in market right now, predicated on the ability to, you know, ride a wave post any potential Google breakup. I just think there's probably an unrealistic driver of any M&A activity right now. Obviously, any type of change, regulatory change to big tech that kind of promotes and creates a freer market is going to be potentially great for a lot of companies. But in terms of the winners and losers of those, it's quite hard to tell at this stage. I'd just be very surprised if there's much big M&A happening off the back of that right now.
Yeah, completely agree with you. In the sense that a lot of the acquisitions in the space, they've tended to be in the areas not yet, you know, dominated by Google. That's why you've seen the likes of CTV platforms, retail media platforms receiving a lot of interest in the last few months. But to your point in terms of how things look going forward, there's a really interesting piece of analysis from Yale recently suggesting that Google would have to divest of both Android and Chrome as a result of the ruling in the Google search case, which obviously could lead to a greater amount of opportunity, particularly in the search market, but that would obviously have a knock-on ramifications in the ad tech space. So yeah, it will be really interesting to see how it all develops going forwards and what potential measures could be. But yes, looking forwards, will we see more diversification-focused purchases from the market, such as those we've seen like Walmart buying up TV manufacturer Vizio? Or will M&A efforts tend towards more consolidation? Off the top of my head, Verve Group snapping up June Group as an example of that one.
This will sound like a very cop-out answer, but you're going to see a lot of both, right? So, and that's really down to the type of strategy as a business you're following. So with the Walmart case, they're obviously trying to own and sort of piece together like a market-leading proposition around the intersection of retail and CTV. So therefore, vertically integrating into hardware, like Vizio, for instance, is a no-brainer. And then in the example you mentioned with Verve, the mobile app space and gaming space, generally speaking, it's a very competitive space, tons of opportunity for consolidation. And you know, perhaps they're of a size and structure now where they can benefit from any sort of potential cost synergies that emerge from any consolidated deals. I don't think there's like a silver bullet, which is, or a golden rule to say, you know, we're going to see more of one or the other. I think it's really dependent on every company and how they're trying to grow their business for the next 3 to 5 years. And is that to, you know, diversify, expand their total addressable markets, enter new markets? Will they be using M&A as a means to doing that? Or are they trying to consolidate their position, whether that's, buying up competitors or vertically integrating the supply chain? I think, you're likely going to see both play out.
Probably a similar answer to the next question, but is this M&A activity a precursor to a rejuvenation of ad tech IPO activity from 2025 onwards?
I don't know whether it's a precursor to ad tech IPO activity generally. I think it's just more a case of, are we seeing the IPO window market open again for businesses generally speaking? And, you know, the absence of many ad tech companies listing is directly related to the general IPO market right now. So I think there is a growing sense of optimism that in the not too distant future, this sort of window or the market for IPOs is going to open again. And with that, you are probably going to start to see a lot of later stage mature ad tech businesses who will see an IPO opportunity as the next sort of logical step. You know, those that have been under the control of private equity for some time now will start to see that as a very valuable exit strategy. But also there might be, you know, also independent companies still who are demonstrating solid financials, demonstrating solid growth on a revenue basis, EBITDA basis, that will also now have an IPO as a you know, a feasible route to liquidation. So or liquidating some shareholdings. So I think what we are going to see is that if the market generally opens for all companies, then it opens up for ad tech just as well. But I don't think you're going to start to see the ad tech industry sort of being the canary down the coal mine, shall we say.
Yeah, being the sole launch of tickers in 2025, yeah, it's going to be more of a diverse range of IPOs coming to fruition. But yeah, again, it'll be really interesting to see those coming forward in many industries. So of course, MIQ itself joined the M&A party in July, buying up US-based media execution partner Parf Labs. So Paul, tell us about that acquisition and what were the key factors driving that acquisition?
Well, it's actually our fourth deal, Matt, but I'll let you off because some of those may have been under the radar. but I think when it comes to companies using M&A as a growth strategy for the business, there's a textbook answer to how and why they do that. From our perspective, it's always around what's the best way of creating value for our business, value for our customers, value for our people, value for our shareholders. And M&A has become an increasingly viable option for us to do that. But we tend to be very selective in what we're pursuing to do that. And for us, it's all around what's going to be accretive to growth. So with the likes of Parf Labs, what we found was an incredible business, solid growth, top line, which again is really important. You know, when you find businesses that are growing consistently way above the market rate on the top line basis, like a revenue basis, it's a real strong indicator of the health of a company. And then obviously, if these companies happen to have strong operating leverage, you see EBITDA margins and profitability sort of increase in line with that. So what we found was a business that was very healthy from a financial perspective, but they were also working with a segment of the market that we didn't really engage with, which is a very sort of, you know, specific set of independent agencies across the US. And that sort of market is huge, largely unaddressed by MIQ, but we also recognized that we had a lot of the product and technical capabilities to bring to that segment of customers that would be really sort of enriching and rewarding and sort of value add for their current relationship with Parf Labs. So it was a bit of a win-win in terms of sort of bringing those companies together. It's opened up an entire new market for us. It's enabled us to really accelerate a few key financial metrics. And we hope it also means that we can start to bring a ton of capability and value to a new set of customers.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's always good to hear when it's a win-win on both for both parties. And yeah, really looking forward to seeing how the acquisition comes together going forward. How was the M&A process? Was it a generally quite a smooth one, or were there things that needed to be ironed out?
M&A process are rarely smooth, it's obviously not. There's not a ton of detail I can go into in terms of some of the specifics, but.
Sure.
You know, there's two types of deals that you engage in M&A. So one is deals that are brought to market by a third party, by a banker. They're running a process, and they are typically, you know, whether it's a short list of companies being targeted initially or quite an open process, but open to strategics, open to institutional investors, open to private equity, open to anyone. And then there's a different type of deal, which is where what we might call proprietary deals, where companies were not actually for sale, but a buyer is, you know, identifying these companies and making the case and convincing the seller to sell. So this was in the latter camp, and you know, sometimes that comes with its own unique set of challenges relative to what might be a more formal timetabled process that a banker is running. So you know, you are firstly convincing a set of founders and management team to consider selling their business, which they may not have done, or they may not have felt they were ready for. So that in and of itself is a huge psychological barrier to help overcome when it comes to a seller who is very happy, you know, running their business successfully before a buyer comes along and tries to disrupt that line of thinking. And then, you know, a lot of that process is around chemistry. It's around culture. You're spending a lot of time on those softer pieces, a lot of time working around strategy. Does it make sense? And I think for us, there's always like a bit of a litmus test, which is what I like to call like the press release litmus test. Or, you know, I think a lot of companies also use this as well, because Amazon do this quite successfully internally ahead of any product launch. They write a press release for a product launch to sort of envision how does it get received and welcomed by customers. And we do the same sort of thing. It's like we imagine going to market and telling our customers or telling the market that we've made a like we've done a deal, in this case, Path Labs. And you've got to think, like, does it make sense? So if MIQ was, for instance, I don't know, acquiring an email marketing platform that was, you know, like a MailChimp or something similar, it's like, yeah, like, you know, email is in the broader scope of digital marketing services. MIQ is in the broad market of digital marketing services. You could, you know, probably try and make a loose connection somewhere, but it would probably feel quite weird and not in a good way. You know, if you were reading that release, say MIQ requires MailChimp, if initial reaction from people and stakeholders and anyone you sort of test on as a focus group says, that feels strange, why would you do that? Why is MIQ buying an email business like MailChimp? It's probably sort of a big sign to say, strategically, it doesn't feel right. And that's what I mean by, you know, this sort of weird factor. It's like, what would your customers think? Would they think that this was of interest to them and useful for them, beneficial for them? Does it help them? So oftentimes we sort of run this sort of process through that lens to try and to understand, does it make sense? So for us, it's like the stages of this process usually goes culture and chemistry first and foremost. When you're a strategic entity like MIQ and you're acquiring a business, you're bringing that company into your business in some way. Regardless of how tightly you integrate them, they're going to be operating under your banner in some shape or form. So you have to connect persons, individuals, you have to share similar values. You have to ensure the culture of these businesses can be meshed together over time. And then second from that is the strategy piece. Does it make strategic sense? This sort of, like I said, this sort of PR test. It's like, does it make sense from a customer lens perspective? And then it sort of goes into the deal mechanics, you know, price, structure, valuations, and those things. And that's where most of the complexity occurs, right? You know, and but you know, there are lots of twists and turns in this deal. But from the outset, we all parties recognized we wanted to work together. We connected as individuals, and we felt it made sense for both of us strategically. If you kind of keep those North Stars in mind, it makes it a little bit easier to navigate the complexities of a deal process when you get more downstream.
Interesting. So interesting. And it's really great to hear that, you know, you guys are going for that holistic approach of blending both the strategy, you know, in terms of how, you know, does this make sense from a financial point of view with the company culture? Because yeah, no one likes to see a forced maneuver in.
You do see a ton of that happening though, right? Which is, yes, you know, and particularly when you see sort of consolidated deals where a competitor just buys a big competitor. There is, like, you know, some strategic sense to doing so sometimes, but oftentimes the lever of value creation is really around costs. Frankly, and like, to be a bit of a cynic, it's like a company is buying another company, stripping out a load of cost, benefiting from those cost synergies, blending down the multiple that they're paying, and therefore sort of arbitraging the value of the business on day one. And that sort of proves out their investment case. And a lot of big business, you know, big deals, when you're sort of doing that process, it unlocks an enormous amount of value on day one, a lot of shareholder value on day one. But for us, it's like, you know, A, we're not like a multi-billion dollar corporation that behaves like that yet. But secondly, we also feel it's not the best intent behind, or best, you know, purpose for doing M&A. It's like, for us, it's all around growth opportunities on the top line. Can you grow revenue, grow a market, help your customers more, rather than can we buy a business, asset strip, cost strip, make it more profitable and benefit from value arbitrage? So that's not the type of M&A we pursue, but plenty do. That's just saying that we are electing at this stage to not go down that path.
Yeah, no, it's completely agreed in the sense that, yeah, those types of acquisitions do happen, which is why, you know, I followed the gaming industry quite closely over the last few years, and the number of layoffs you're seeing at studios there, which have been acquired by the larger conglomerates within the space, shows that may not be the the best approach in terms of obviously your staff, but yes, it can obviously be a hugely, hugely profitable one. Zooming out into an ongoing trend which has been picked up over the last year or so, in that 2024 has seen a sharp increase in European advertising firms buying US-based companies against the predominant trend over the last decade or so. We've seen Equative combining with ShareThrough, Verve Group buying June Group, as flagged earlier, Seedtag snapping up Beachfront, and of course NIQ acquiring Path Labs as examples of this. Paul, what are the reasons behind this reversal, and is the trend set to continue?
I wouldn't say there's not a reason why Europeans are starting to sort of buy up US assets. I think it's just a consequence that there is a selection of a few European founded companies who have done well over years and have grown to a size where they can, raise debt, use cash flow, or other means of capital, like raising to acquire smaller businesses. It just so happens that these companies that you've just mentioned, all of us have a presence or a largest presence now in the US, which is also probably why these European companies are, in their own right, pretty big now, because a big portion of their business is probably from the US. And therefore, expanding, consolidating, enhancing their US presence is obviously another key strategy for growth. I don't know whether it's like a huge trend, or it's just like a bit of an outlier of a few firms who just happen to be European founded and have succeeded. But obviously the US is still and remains a huge market for growth for any company, particularly those in Europe who are likely finding it easier to, I wouldn't say easy, but maybe easier to, once they've found some sort of product market fit in the US market, finding it easier to scale the US market than they would do scaling a very fragmented pan-Euro market. So it would not be a surprise if all the companies you've mentioned have a much, much bigger US business than they have a European business now from a revenue perspective. And it's certainly true in our case, maybe in the others you've mentioned. It's a consequence of the US market being such a huge opportunity. So companies you mentioned are either consolidating their position or looking to expand and grow rapidly.
So is the egg following the chicken rather than the chicken following the egg? How can European tech companies, obviously you mentioned having a large US presence as a reason why European tech firms are expanding more into that market, but maybe if they don't have such a high presence, how can European tech companies position themselves to acquire companies within that North American market?
Well, they obviously need to be big enough to acquire someone in the US market. It's possible though. If you're a relatively large European business and you have a very small American footprint, then as long as you have, again, your profit making, so you can leverage with debt to raise funds to acquire a business, there's nothing stopping a European business going out to the US and doing that. I don't think you shouldn't overthink the, how can a European get into American businesses and convince them to sell? It's probably a bit easier than that. Like I said, particularly when there's a process involved and bankers are appointed to sell a business, they won't be picky in terms of who should be a potential buyer. And the fact that you're just European domiciled doesn't necessarily make it harder. It's really around, do you have the funds in place to do the deals? Do you have the right structure for management teams to incentivize them if need be? And do you have the right capacity to integrate a business in the US and to integrate it culturally? As long as you can tick those boxes, there's nothing stopping more European businesses acquiring smaller US businesses.
That's a hugely interesting point to finish up on, Paul. Thank you ever so much for your time today. It's been a really interesting discussion on all things mergers and acquisitions.
Thanks, Matt. And speak to you soon.
And thank you all for listening to this edition of the MadTech Podcast Special.